The Book Nook on WYSO is presented by the Greene County Public Library with additional support from Clark County Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, Washington Centerville Public Library, and Wright Memorial Public Library.
Good morning. Welcome to the Best of the Book Nook on WYSO. Hope you're having a good holiday weekend. I'm Vic McCunis, and we went back into our archive 25 years to pull out an interview I did with the philosopher Daniel Quinn talking about his memoir, Providence, the story of a 50-year vision quest. And when I looked in the archive, I thought, I better check to make sure he's doing okay. He's got to be in his mid-80s by now. And I looked him up, and I found that he had died 3 years ago. And I was stunned because this is a man who did not get an obituary in the New York Times. I could not find one. And he was somewhat controversial. His book, Ishmael, has been a perennial bestseller. It was reissued for a 25th anniversary edition. He was an amazing man. Whether you agree or disagree with him, he certainly could pique your interest with some of his comments. Let's listen now to Daniel Quinn talking about Providence, the story of a 50-year vision quest. But first, I asked him about his book, Ishmael, on WYSO.
Ishmael is the story of a youngish man who is in desperate need of a teacher, and he goes looking for a teacher, and he finds a teacher that he didn't expect to find, who happens to be a lowland gorilla who, since he is a gorilla and speaks for the community, the rest of the community of life on this planet, this teacher gives him a new vision of human history and of our place in the universe.
And I think one of the points that you bring forth in Ishmael is, as humans, we have forgotten who we are.
We certainly have, yeah. We, in our culture, the culture that is now dominant on this planet, this culture is about 10,000 years ago. It began with an agricultural revolution that began in the Near East. And we began at that time to forget that there was a past, and it came, all of our ideas are based on the idea that humans have not really been around very long, and that the human race is exactly as old as our own culture, as a matter of fact, and that the human race is our culture. And so it came as quite a shock when paleontologists of the last century began to demonstrate that we were much, 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 much older than that. And we have not made contact with our past. We've said the past is of no importance at all. We don't even have a name for the way of life that these people have. We call them primitive. We call them Stone Age, as though stones meant anything to them. They had no interest in stones. They didn't make stones the way we make movies or anything like that. Stones were just tools.
That leads us to the current book. And I just finished it this morning. It's called Providence, the Story of a 50-Year Vision Quest. And you begin the book with a quote that really had an impact on me. Only slaves love being powerful. Tell us about that.
Seems to touch a chord in me, too. Only slaves love being powerful. This is so much the story of where we are right now. And power is so important to people now. People seem to be more anxious to have power these days than even 50 years ago, or everyone is up in arms about getting some power for themselves. And this is because we feel so helpless with the tremendous onrush that we have towards oblivion in our culture. We know that we're heading towards a terrible catastrophe. And so it becomes more and more important for us to have our own little safe place where we are powerful. Somewhere in our life we can move into this place and say, well, by God, you know, here nobody can touch me. I'm the boss. Because we know that the whole thing is just on a track that is just plunging towards doom.
So we're literally riding on the highway to hell, and yeah. And our desire to somehow fulfill that emptiness, to somehow take care of that neediness that so many people feel, that desire to control, that desire to dominate, really goes against the ability to fulfill that need in a way.
Yes. Yeah, we're like, to take it back to the image of the slaves, we're like slaves in a slave ship chained to the bottom, and we can see that the water is rising. There's a hole in the bottom, and we're all going down.
Early in the new book, on page 11, you state that telling the truth is a struggle. Telling lies is easy.
Yes, yes.
And so many books that we read are just fantasies. They're just escapes for people. And you came from a very, I don't know if it's a unique background, but in the book, to use a common term that is bandied about now, you came from a very dysfunctional family.
Yes, I came from a dysfunctional family.
You grew up in Omaha, and you had a lot of struggle with your identity as a person. You had a lot of self-doubt. You had incredibly low self-esteem, and you were searching. And in your search, you had a dream back in 1941 that really was a destiny-type dream for you. It was a vision of a beetle talking to you. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I was coming back in this dream. I was age 5 or 6 and coming back from a movie in the streets of Omaha, Nebraska, and I came across a felled tree, and I didn't know what was going on, and as I was standing there, a beetle came scurrying down the branch and said, "Don't be alarmed. I just wanted to talk to you, and that's why we dumped this tree in your track, so we would be able to stop you." And I was completely flabbergasted that a beetle would want to talk to me, and we exchanged a few remarks, and then the beetle said, "Look over there." And I looked to my right, and there was a clearing, and in the middle of this clearing stood a deer. And the beetle said, "The deer is waiting, wants to lead you into the forest." And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because we need you there. We need to tell you the secrets of our lives." And I was completely enchanted and mystified, and was ready to step off the sidewalk when the dream abruptly ended, and I was completely crushed and horrified that I hadn't been allowed to do this thing, even though I hadn't at all been a boy attracted to nature or anything like that. I had no interest in the animals or bugs or deer or forests, not a bit. And the strangeness of this dream didn't leave me, and I never forgot the dream, and it only began to make sense to me later in my life as I began to see that in some sense or other I was needed there. Even though, as I say, I'm not at all a naturalist, not even a camper, that what I do in the Ishmael is to reveal secrets that are not secrets really to naturalists or biologists, but they're secrets to most readers in our culture. They're secrets that Aboriginal peoples have been trying to tell us for a long, 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 long time, but they were unable to tell us these things in our own terms, and that I could do because I happen to be a member of this culture myself, went to the right schools and so on.
You were translating the obvious, in other words.
Yes.
You mentioned nature, and the fact in your book you state that man feels separate from nature, and that nature is some ideal that was promulgated as a romantic notion. You don't mention Rousseau, but I think he was one of the people that created this image. And you make the point that there's a web, that we are all connected, that we are not separate, that everything is connected, and that this is one of the reasons why mankind is having a difficult time now, because we are trying so hard to control everything. We're not being a part of it, like prehistoric peoples. They were a part of nature. We are trying to dominate it and control it. And
we're trying to pretend that we're not part of nature. We still are, every bit as much. I don't have to go outside and stand by that tree out there in order to be part of nature, because I am inextricably part of nature. Nothing I can do will remove me from nature. And it's in fact, it is nature that is getting back at us, because we are trying to live as though we're not part of it. We're saying, oh, yes, we can wipe out all life on this planet and just live out of canned goods. No, folks, you know, you can't do it. It won't work. But really, there are a lot of people in the world who actually do really think that. And that I know I heard, I was tooling down the road a few weeks ago, I heard on a talk show, I don't even know who it was, some talk show host who was saying, well, yes, suppose we do lose the songbirds. We don't need songbirds. You know, we can do without songbirds. You know, I mean, sure, they're nice. But this guy had the idea that the songbirds were there to amuse us. They're part of our entertainment package here on this planet. But that's, you know, the songs are just something we appreciate. But without those birds, we are in big trouble. Not because we don't have the pleasant sounds to listen to.
Was he talking about automatic weapons? That wasn't G. Gordon Liddy, was it?
No, it wasn't.
On your quest, you end up as a 19-year-old at the Trappist Monastery, Our Lady of Gethsemane in Kentucky. And your novice master there was Thomas Merton, who I'm sure is well known to our audience. You knew him as Father Lewis?
Yes.
You had a vision at the monastery in 1954. Everything was burning. You call it infused contemplation. Tell us about this.
Infused contemplation is the technical word, as is known in contemplative circles. It is monstrously difficult to talk about it, to describe it. It isn't even a vision in the way that most people understand it, in that I was not hallucinating anything. I wasn't seeing images of things that weren't there. Everything was infused with an illumination. That was completely overpowering and extraordinary. So that it did look as though everything was burning from something from within. And at the time, I accepted this as something within the framework of the contemplative life. And only later did I realize that this experience has nothing at all to do with the Christian mythology in which monasticism exists, so that it wasn't at all a Christian vision, and it was the basis of, it was the other point on the path, the first point being the dream that I had as a child, and then this vision pointing me towards something which was a different way of looking at the world.
And shortly after this occurrence, Thomas Merton, your novice master, Father Lewis, asked you to leave the monastery. And you were pretty crestfallen about this. And the next thing you know, you're at the Menninger Clinic in Topeka, and you're being analyzed. And you went through a lot of stuff at this point in your life. You had your father come and pick you up, and you thought you'd have confidentiality, and the next thing you know, the doctor is telling your father all these things that he thinks are wrong with you, and you end up in a marriage that wasn't right for you with several children, and you were searching so hard, and you were having so much difficulty in your life, and suddenly you meet your soulmate, who you brought along with you today. And I thought that was such a wonderful story of how you met her at that party, wasn't it?
Yes.
And the salesman was putting the moves on her, and you just stepped right in there, and you were so assertive. It's like you had come out of your shell finally after all of these years. And you keep talking about God in the book, and your search for something to believe in. And you talk about God in the Christian way for a long time, and then you get to the point where you're referring to God as it. Do you consider yourself an atheist?
No. There was a time after I became disenchanted with Christianity when I had nothing to replace it with, and I more and more had nothing that I could point to as a spiritual life, and yet I had those two events in my past, particularly the event at the monastery, that I had to somehow or other explain, because, as I say, it wasn't a hallucination, it wasn't something that happened in a while I was under the influence of a drug or anything like that. It was a part of my life that wouldn't go away, and when I began working on the book that ultimately became Ishmael, I was still virtually a person without a religion at all. And as I look back into the past that we have cut ourselves off from, I made the remarkable discovery, which is sort of generally, sort of vaguely known to everyone, that there once was on this planet a universal religion practiced everywhere in really amazingly much the same way. You could go anywhere in the world and find the same religious attitudes at work, even though this had never come about because of any organization. There had never been any crusaders or any missionaries spreading this religion. It had simply sort of come into being along with our own humanness. And as I looked more and more into this into the religious attitudes that you find among Aboriginal peoples today, much as in the past, I began to refashion my own thoughts and ultimately to identify with their own religious attitudes.
And you're referring to animism.
Yes.
Animism was a belief that was held in many different ways by these ancient cultures in the prehistorical period.
Well, it's not prehistorical. It's still as much valid today as ever. These are not prehistoric peoples. These are modern people.
Okay. The keeping of history and the creation of our major religions tend to ignore the fact that mankind has been here for a tremendously long time, and we evolved, and Darwin shattered the myth, and it continues to be shattered on a daily basis by researchers and scientists, etc. Do you believe that modern religion, Judaism, Christianity, etc., is willing to ever accept the fact that mankind has been here a lot longer? Historians, do you think that they will ever accept that? It seems that what they have recorded and what they believe is written in stone, so to speak, and there's no way they can adjust their beliefs.
I think that's very true. They don't want to adjust their beliefs. They were formed at a time when everybody assumed that humankind was just a few thousand years old and that humankind was born an agriculturalist, that people appeared on this planet and immediately became agriculturalists and immediately began building civilization. And when it turned out that this wasn't the case, everyone simply said, well, okay, but we'll just go on pretending that really that's what happened anyway. And so that now what you see is that people imagine that the 3 million years that came before were simply a prelude, and they don't count. So the real thing started when our culture started. And in the same way that real religions started when our religion started, and the ones that came before were just preliminaries, were just warm-ups, that people were, you know, they were sort of primitive, and so they didn't have the real stuff. But as a matter of fact, people as modern as we are were here 100,000 years ago. These were not shuffling ape men. These were people who could, if you had one who was an infant and you brought it up, you would not be able to tell this infant from you or I. And would be able to be a computer specialist or a radio engineer or anything.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned in the new book that you considered yourself a member of the Silent Generation, which was a term I think that was coined by the Atlantic Monthly back in 1955. It's not a very familiar term to me. Could you illuminate our listeners on that one?
The Silent Generation. Was coined to describe a generation who were silent, of course. They were hard to look at because they were so self-effacing. They were really trying to hide themselves away. We didn't have any life expectancy at all because we grew up, we were the first generation to grow up in the shadow of the mushroom cloud. And everyone kept telling us that any day now, the hydrogen bomb was going to fall. It was going to be all over. And so it was our idea that the best thing for us to do was just keep our head down and get whatever we could and try to pretend that, you know, that everything was okay. And so at that time, everybody, on getting out of college or getting out of high school, you got married, you got a job, you got a house in the suburbs, you got a car, and you just settled down and said, well, here I am, you know. And you didn't make waves, did not make waves.
Those were the 50s. Get everything you can, get your peace, get your family, do it all now, because tomorrow you could be blown into oblivion.
Absolutely. And so when the 60s came along, the mid-60s and the early 70s, this just wiped us out. It wiped me out in any case, because here were kids who were no longer thinking about the bomb. They had forgotten about the bomb, or they just didn't care. They said, we're not going to live this way.
The flower children.
Yeah, the flower children. And I said, yes, they're absolutely right. The way I'm living is dumb. And I sort of had to reshape my life at that point.
And you decided at that point that you had become a liberated man. But this turned out to be a facade.
Yes. Well, naturally, I wanted to be a liberated man. The sexual revolution was on its way. And I had never tasted anything like that. And I wanted to do it. And so I put myself out there as a single man and found out that I was a dinosaur and really unready to associate with the people that I wanted to associate with. And this was very lucky for me as I saw that I had important changes to make in myself. I have one of the few wonderful psychotherapy stories. I don't hear many of those, people who've had good experience with it, but I had a wonderful psychotherapist in Chicago who told me that she said, there's not much wrong with you. And I said, oh, I just thought that was terribly funny because I thought there was nothing, absolutely nothing right with me. And she said, "In someday, I guarantee you, you will be filled with self-esteem and you will feel wonderful." And I just laughed at her. But it did come about. It took a couple of years, and I saw what had happened to me in my youth, and I saw that my parents didn't value me, and I saw that their opinion was not the only opinion in the world, and that they weren't necessarily right, and that I could value myself in spite of them. And so I sort of began all over again at that point. I was reborn then, and that's when I met Rennie, was that the two events were practically simultaneous.
Suddenly there was this convergence of good things in your life. You started writing down a list of the things that were good about yourself, and you realized you weren't so bad after all.
That's right, yes.
Daniel, in your new book, you have a quote, just very briefly, you say that, "I should add that this is just as true for vegetarians as for anyone else. Vegetarians who feel morally superior because they never eat animals are exhibiting what might be called kingdomism, in effect assigning a greater sacredness to members of their own kingdom, the animal kingdom, than to the plant kingdom." I found this very compelling.
It upsets people. It upsets some people who are otherwise fans of my book because they want me to endorse vegetarianism as a way of life and to come out against using animals as food and denounce it as a bad thing. And I can't do this because we cannot live except by taking life from other species.
Whether it's a plant
or
an animal.
We cannot live on rocks. Absolutely cannot do it. And the only thing on this planet that does not take its life from other creatures are the green plants. And everything begins there, of course. And I'm not arguing for animal consumption. I just refuse to take a moral position and saying that animals are better than plants.
And that was Daniel Quinn on the Best of the Book Nook, recorded 25 years ago, talking about his memoir, Providence, the story of a 50-year vision quest. A controversial man he was. He died 3 years ago. Quinn describes civilization as primarily a single global economy and culture whose total dependence on agriculture requires ever more expansion, in turn generating ever more population growth, an escalating vicious cycle he identifies as the food race. As a result, he viewed modern civilization by definition as unsustainable. He was quite a thinker and a philosopher and very controversial during his lifetime, and still apparently controversial because the New York Times, when he died 3 years ago, did not publish an obituary for Daniel Quinn. I cannot believe this oversight. I'm going to email one of the obituary writers right now and say, you need to write an obituary for Daniel Quinn. For the Best of the Book Nook, I'm Vic McCunis. Thanks as always for tuning in. Hope you have a really safe 4th of July.